I've got something to celebrate soon.
Oh.
Oh, do ya?
In a few days, I will have held the PCW Women's title for a year. I've held it for 361 days. I'd love to have defended it a lot more than I have in that time, but I don't make those decisions. But, yeah, I believe I might be their longest, like, running champion now.
I mean, look, everyone's just afraid to take you on. You are just clearly the champion. Why even attempt to take the belt from the winner?
I have heard I'm the first champion in a while that didn't fuck off the moment I won the belt, so I think I get points for sticking around.
Is that an option? Can I win, like, a contested belt in something and then just decide to leave and take the belt with me and be like, no one can contest the belt if I leave?
I don't think they've ever taken the belt. It's not like the Monday Night Wars.
Oh, okay, I see. Like, they put it up for grabs, not just being like, no, this is my belt, off I fuck.
That did happen. During the aforementioned Monday Night Wars, WCW, when they were a thing, versus WWF, their women's champion, I can't remember if it was Medusa or Alundra Blaze. I think they're the same person. Alundra Blaze, I think, was the women's champion at the WWF, signed over to WCW while still holding the title, appeared on WCW's program and threw it in the bin.
Oh, that's...
Yes.
Beautiful, if short-sighted, long-term.
Yeah.
I appreciate the move.
That's why they had the famous Montreal screwjob where, you know, Bret Hart was the champion. They were worried he was going to go WCW with it, like, do that again. So Shawn Michaels puts Bret Hart in the figure four, in the sharpshooter, and Vince just runs out and just yells, ring the fucking bell. And Shawn Michaels, credit to him, best actor in the world, pretending he's annoyed that the match got fucked up and he got given the belt. Acting all confused when he was in it, like, from the start. Like, this big conspiracy around this pretend sport. I love wrestling. It's the worst shit.
There's a part of me that when you were just reflecting on the Montreal screwjob and how the concern was that the belt would go to WCW in that way, it struck me at first. I was like, oh, come on, that's so lame, they wouldn't do it twice. And then I remembered, wasn't Vince Russo heading up creative at WCW at this point?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
He's okay, so yes, it absolutely would have happened twice.
Yes, I mean, the man who in his WWF tenure came up with the character of Beaver Cleavage, who I think is the one of the most underrated wrestlers ever. He ended up becoming one half of the Headbangers, but it was this, like, Beaver Cleavage, like, obviously, like a play on words, if you want to call it that. They had vignettes where he was this dressed up like a schoolboy in, like, black and white sitcom style filming, where the sole aim of these vignettes was to make it quite clear that the boy wants to fuck his mum.
Oh.
That was it. It was just innuendo, heavily suggesting, all but saying, that there is sexual tension between Beaver Cleavage and his mum, presumably Mrs. or Ms. Cleavage.
Well, judging by how the porn industry has turned in recent decades, maybe Vince Russo was just a man ahead of his time.
Yeah, just ahead of the curves. That's wrestling. I've been studying Beaver Cleavage's matches because he's just written off as a joke, but I saw one by accident, which is the only way people see them. And he was doing some cool shit. I actually ended up developing, like, this original spot because I was trying to do something he was doing but couldn't, and I fucked it up, but then we came up with something else. So, yeah, Beaver Cleavage, if any aspiring wrestlers want to model themselves after something, look him up, preferably on a bus. And you won't need headphones. Just crank that up.
Welcome to the position.
Yeah, I'm done. Thank you.
this is the bit where I sense enough of a pause to go, maybe we can video games now. Perhaps, possibly. It's Podquisition. We talk about video games here sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's played some of them this week?
I have only played one game, so I'm going to wait, because I'm sure you've both played something.
I've only played one. Well, I've only played one I can talk about so far. The other one is embargoed till next week, so yeah.
Okay, I've played a few things, and I'm going to start with one that specifically I think Conrad's gonna fucking dig.
Yeah.
I've been playing a good amount of a game called Balatro.
Yes.
And this game has been, like, floating around me for a couple of weeks with people asking if I've played it, and, you know, I wasn't entirely sold on it until I started playing it, and now it's my new absolute fucking addiction. So the simple way to describe Balatro is it is a deck-building roguelike about building poker hands from cards. And the gist of it is that you're trying to get through 8 rounds, each of which consists of, like, 3 smaller matches, where you're basically trying to score a specific score across a number of hands to hit the target you're looking for and keep going. And the way that you do this is partially by building traditional poker hands, and, you know, the much like traditional poker, certain hands are more valuable than others, and that sort of tends to manifest as having a higher modifier associated with your score. Your score is, like, the numbers on your cards multiplied by the modifier for whatever hand you've put together is the basic. But throughout it, you are collecting income that you're spending between poker hands to purchase a bunch of weird modifiers that will drastically impact how the scoring is done, to try and create, like, weird little combos of this is not how poker's meant to work, but it's what's making my poker hand work. Some of these modifiers will be pretty simple. They might be things like anytime your poker hand includes, like, odd cards or even cards, get an increase to your base score or to your modifier. Sometimes they'll be more specific. They'll be like, any aces used in a successful poker hand will have this kind of impact. Some of them require specific hands to be built. And all of these synergize in different ways. So you end up less interested in making, like, in traditional poker, the best poker hand, but trying to create a poker hand that satisfies as many of your weird self-imposed conditions as possible to rack up multipliers. A good example of this is I was doing a run of this just before recording, where the things I was being majorly rewarded for were having odd-numbered cards in my successful hand, for having hearts in my successful hand, and having a pair involved in my successful hands. So I ended up doing a lot of pairs of trying to get, like, pairs of hearts, odd pairs, ideally aces, because aces were giving me particular bonuses, and getting, like, 2 pair was way better than getting a straight for me. Add on to this, you have, like, booster pack mechanics that you can do between these hands of poker that fundamentally change the poker deck. Things like, do you want to just add more of certain cards to your deck so it's not a 52-card deck? You know, now it's like, this deck has 5 aces in it, so you can have 5 of a kind on aces, and that's a submittable hand now. You can start adding cards that have unique modifiers to them. Sometimes you'll have cards that are things like, if you keep it in your hand and don't use it, you'll get bonuses. You can get from these booster packs activatable abilities you can use on specific rounds. And all of this sort of culminates to every 3rd round of poker you're doing is a boss round, and these will have some kind of difficult stipulation attached to them. A fairly common one that I remember seeing come up is something like, cards of this suit will not get you base points when used in hands this turn, or won't activate their abilities. I had one where it was, any cards you used in the last 2 games of poker you did are just not available to you this game. Weird little modifiers like that that you have to be prepared for and work around. As you try and do this, I guess, 24 successful rounds of escalating point scoring poker hands and remembering what weird mess of things you've decided is your point scoring values this time. It is really simple. I like that it has a lot of mechanics around being able to discard cards from your hand on a regular basis to build towards specific hands that are good for your point scoring. There are nice modifiers, things like different starting decks that will allow you to do things like play more hands of poker before you have to have hit that score barrier, or starting with some additional income for buying things to modify your deck with. And it all comes together to be this really quick, snappy game of putting together point scoring hands and then watching bing, bing, ping, 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 all the little modifiers that you've set up activating one after another, and your score going up and up and up. It's big old dopamine factory, and while it is ostensibly about poker, it each run very quickly becomes forget the rules of poker, think about the rules of whatever card game I've invented here.
Yeah.
It's really good.
This is really interesting. Using poker as the basis for scoring, but then completely remixing that based on how you have played is fascinating. Because I'm bad at poker. Like, the odds-making element of it isn't something that my brain properly calculates for some reason.
Here's a nice thing about this. It really does a lot to strip the odds-making elements out of it. One of the things you can do at any time is just look at what cards are left in your deck and see which cards could still come up.
Mm.
Like, you won't know the order they're coming in,
sure.
But you can just have a look and go, okay, I'm looking for a three. I don't remember. Do I have any of those left? Yeah, I can just look. Yeah, there's still some threes in the deck. Like, it does a lot to simplify that kind of what is coming up, what have I tried to remember stuff. And, like, each run within two or three matches, you've got a couple of modifiers. The actual poker hands don't fucking matter. They really don't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I do, like a straight or a flush, I might get, like, a times six multiplier on whatever hand I submitted. Very quickly you'll be like, yeah, but I could get like a times 30 multiplier if I just stick to the things that like I've decided are my scoring values.
Right.
That element to it, and the ability to start going, cool, I'm getting rewarded for, you know, hands that involve odd cards, for example. I'm just going to start adding additional odd cards to my deck, so I've got like a shit ton more threes, fives, and sevens. It really is just like weighting the dice as much as possible toward the thing that you tend to do anyway.
Right.
And I know for me, I have a tendency towards, like, aiming for certain poker hands, and I'm like, cool, I recognize that tendency in myself, I'm just gonna make that my end game. And that is making me enjoy it a lot more than I expected to enjoy a game based in poker.
Yeah, this is very cool. I will definitely be taking a look at this. It's very interesting.
I need to put more time into it. I was gonna put like half an hour in, and then 2 hours had passed. It's one of those.
Right.
And I don't know how much more I'm gonna have to say over it over the coming weeks, other than it's scratching a real particular itch. And when I was playing it, I was thinking about you having gotten really into the slot machine deck builder-y game that we talked about. What was it? Luck Be a Landlord?
Yeah.
It made me... I feel like it's going to scratch a similar itch for you.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I've actually played two hands of it while you were describing it. And
yeah.
This is going to be my speed. I'm definitely going to be losing some of the rest of my week to it, for sure.
Nice. I'm going to quickly rattle through a couple of other things I've been playing, because there's some of them that really don't need me to talk about for particularly long. I got back into playing stuff on the playdate this week.
Ooh.
I found a couple of interesting new things that I've been having some fun with. One of them's really simple. It is a game called Pull Frog. It is Tetris. If you were a little frog inside the rectangle where Tetris is happening, and if you want to move a piece, you have to stick your tongue out and pull it with your tongue while it's still in the air.
Huh.
But if a piece has landed and, like, you know, it's covering a gap and it's not in the right place, you can, once it's, like, stationary, you can fire your tongue at pieces of the palimino and break them down. So, like, let's say there's an L-shaped piece, and if it was a line rather than L-shape, it would have fallen into a gap. I can take the little bit at the bottom that's sticking out as an L and spend some time attacking that. Now it's a straight piece that will fall into the gap it's above.
Huh.
It is a weirdly addictive little game. It has mechanics as you go throughout for, once you've cleared a certain number of lines, building up your build and being able to do modifiers like having a longer tongue, jumping higher, more quickly breaking down blocks, things like that. But it is fundamentally like, how would you do a Tetris if it was considerably harder to move pieces, but also you had more tools to deal with poorly placed pieces once they're in place? It's pretty neat. It's got charming music and a neat little art style to it. The other one I've started playing on Playdate, and this is one I've been looking forward to for a while because of who the creator behind it was, is a game that came out yesterday called Mars After Midnight. And this is a new game exclusive for the Playdate by Lucas Pope, who is the person behind Papers, Please, yes. Return of the Obra Dinn, all of that stuff. And the best way I can explain Mars After Midnight right now is, what if silly, goofy, alien Papers, Please without the stress and panic? You are an alien on Mars working at some kind of business that, like, is rented out between midnight and 5 a.m. for various functions. And you are basically working as the door person, letting people in or refusing them for whatever event and function you've put on. And all of these events and functions are sort of themed. So one of them was a tiny knife-wielding gnat fight night. And it was just tiny little insects with knives. And my job on the door was to, every time someone knocked, I had to sort of open the window up and use my little magnifying glass to try and work out, are you indeed a gnat with a knife, or am I sending you away? In between which, as I let people in, using my many, many tentacles to try and reorganize and tidy and sort out the refreshments table to everyone's liking, in between getting hassled with people who are clearly not gnats with knives trying to get in. And there's a good amount of variety in the kinds of things that you're being tasked with checking people for at the door. One of the first ones I did was something called Fart Party, which was purely I had to open the little window of my thing and wait for a minute and check if this alien was farting. No fart, no entry. The window you're looking out of is not big enough to see the entire alien you are judging. You've got to, like, peer up, peer down to, like, get little bits of extra angle to see. And you were just looking, you were looking or listening for, did you do a real rumbly fart? Cool, you can join the fart party. Some of them are things like, I think the first one is Cyclops Anger Management. And you are specifically looking for, do you have one eye and are you pissed off? And sometimes you have to start, like, really thinking about alien anatomy and going, what constitutes an eye and a face on you? Because there was someone in that first one, in the Cyclops Anger Management, that I kept turning away and he kept coming back and I was like, why are you coming back? You have two eyes. Nope. I'd seen two things that were sort of circular, assumed they were eyes, turned him away, hadn't looked up to see his clearly one eye. I don't know what the fuck those two things I was looking at were, but I hadn't even bothered to look further up his face because I'd ruled him out. And you basically have to, like, set up these events, cater for them, advertise for them, and then be the little door person, trying to understand what the fuck you're looking at with regards to these baffling alien designs, and interpret, do I think you make sense for this function? Am I gonna let someone in who's not meant to be here? It's a really charming little game. Clearly a lot of effort has been put into coming up with a really large variety of different, like, distinct feeling alien designs that thus far I've not felt like anything has repeated itself sort of thematically in that regard. Yeah, it's a fun little, it takes maybe like 10-15 minutes at a time to do one of these runs, and at the end of it you're unlocking more of these to do, and it seems like there's a pretty good amount of stuff already from what I can see available to go through. It's pretty charming. It really does feel like the person who made Papers, Please went, what if I made Papers, Please, but didn't traumatize everyone this time?
Yeah.
And it's pretty charming. So yeah, that's a couple of Playdate things I played this week that I thought were pretty nice. What about both of you? You've both played a thing this week. Does either of you want to say what it is?
Well,
it's Final Fantasy VII is the one I can talk about, which okay. I know you'll have played more of since we last spoke about it.
Yeah, I've been sticking to it at the weekends with Jane, so I might not be as far as you.
Right.
We've been doing like a couple of binge days every week on it so far.
Yeah, I'm really, really far in.
Okay.
About two people in the world got my Dragnet reference when I said that Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is to Final Fantasy VII what Dragnet is to Dragnet. But I truly believe that.
I get that joke.
Yeah, I don't even think it's a joke. Like, I was playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and I'm like, it's like they're taking the piss. and it's good.
Right.
And it's not nasty.
Right.
Like, it's just having fun.
It loves the source material yes. on sub-level.
Yeah, it's that line between parody and homage. It's not a remake in the truest sense. It's a remake in the way that, you know, you describe something like that kind of homage parody thing. First of all, there's quite a bit in it that relies on subverting your expectations if you've already played the original PlayStation 1.
Mm. Sure.
And the first one had some of that too. But as I play, I'm like, it's hard to argue this is a full proper, like, restart in any way. I mean, it can be enjoyed independent of the original, but so much of truly understanding and appreciating it relies on that. And I like that. That's not a criticism. Mm. That's one of the things I really liked about Remake. It could be enjoyed differently, and it was actually set up within canon to be a different thing. And that's been continued. A lot of my thoughts are still the same in regards to the overwhelming amount of minigames. I have, after like 50 hours, I have reached a point where I've started like skipping the occasional sort of like particularly dreary dialogue scene for side quests, or like I've seen whole like minigame things now and I'm just like, nah. And then I just move on. And that works out better for me.
I can get that to a degree already. Me and Jane recently reached, and I'm going to be vague about this, one particular environment that is absolutely chock-a-block with minigames, that is like a very dense population of a lot of minigames located together. And I really enjoyed that, but I can see how that could be wearing.
I'll say this. I got to an area where there was lots of minigames. In the original Final Fantasy VII, that was quite an interesting thing. In Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, I agree with Barrett when he said, I got all my fun done in the last town. Like, by the time I got to the bit that should have been, like, the most fun, like, minigame-centric area, I was done. I was like, but I've done nothing but minigames in every town on the way here. This is prettier, but it's just a continuation. For me, anyway, a lot of what made that special in, I don't know why I'm acting like it's a secret. It's the Gold Saucer. Kate Sith's in the fucking game.
Yeah.
Like, what made Gold Saucer so special in the original was it did stand out. It was a bit different. It was where you went and felt like you were taking a break from the rest of it. In this game, I want to know where I take a break from the fun. Like, where do I take a break from the games? Where's that resort where I can just sit down, like, have a cup of tea and a tuna sandwich? So I'm still very overwhelmed by the amount of minigames and how that affects pacing. I think the game is genius. I haven't got to the end yet, and there is stuff that needs to be seen, but I am sort of veering on that, because I was a bit torn last week. No matter how many bits in it frustrate me, like the entire Gongaga area, there is so much where I am baffled and will never forget what it just tried to show me as acceptable. There are things this game tries to convince me are okay to put in a game, and I love that it just, like, it doesn't care whether I approve or not. It doesn't care whether anyone approves of what this game does. It's doing its own thing. And like I said last week, the idea that they could just point to Final Fantasy VII, like one of the most critically acclaimed games of all time, and just thought, you know what, I bet we can ruin that and people will adore us for it. Like, no matter what else I might think, I have to be impressed at what they've committed.
It is a fascinating game.
Fascinating.
I am genuinely loving the nonsense it is full of. I have been enjoying every minute of it, but it is a very divisive thing to offer in what initially seemed like it might be a fairly straightforward remake of Final Fantasy VII, and I am all for it.
Yeah, really, really enjoying it. I mean, I have been, like, glued for hours and hours and hours. There is a lot I love about it. Like, again, I worry that it sounds like I'm being negative when I am thrilled this game exists. While I have my issues with it, I am blown away. And yeah, it really has that Barbie feel to me, that kind of, I don't know how they got away with it, but I'm kind of glad they did. I wanted to mention Queen's Blood as well. Like, of all the minigames, they definitely nailed it with Queen's Blood. That is great.
Apparently they've had enough positive feedback about Queen's Blood that the creators have been like, we're looking at if we can expand the offering of Queen's Blood at all for players because people are enjoying it.
Yeah.
It sure sounds like they might just, like, add more cards in or make it a spin-off mode or something. I'm like, good idea. Queen's Blood is fucking great.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way they weren't gonna jump on that because everyone I've spoken to loves Queen's Blood.
There's like a handful of games in this where I'm like, if you let me access this from the main menu and gave it an online multiplayer component, I would play a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's all I need you to do is enable online multiplayer and put it on the main menu, and I will play the shit out of a few of these games within the game.
Yeah, like, I've got a lot of thoughts, and it's hard to kind of condense them. I think I'm doing an entire video on Kate Sith on Monday.
Mm.
I approve of this.
It's possibly... Now, look, I'm not one for hyperbole.
What, you?
Kate Sith and the Moogle are possibly the best character animation I've seen in a mainstream game.
Oh my god, they're fucking great.
Incredible. The movement on the Moogle, the softness it communicates, and the squish it communicates.
And the way that the two of them interact sort of separately and together is really wonderful.
The way they play is fantastic.
Mm.
I think Rebirth will do a lot to rehabilitate Kate Sith, because a lot of people consider Kate Sith annoying in the original. I always loved it because...
My favourite.
As a kid, I gravitated towards less human, like, characters and things.
I getcha.
Kate Sith was a cat on a big Moogle, and that was cool. And he had cool music and all these, like, fun luck-based things that everyone hates, but I really liked.
I loved that he was the corporate, like, guy who had something resembling a soul.
Yeah.
That was what attracted me to him.
They amp that up in this.
Yeah, they make a lot of things a lot clearer to lean more into that aspect.
Yeah, and they make Kate Sith a lot more likable as a result, I think, for a lot of people. But yeah, always loved Kate Sith. I really like the characterization they've done. I think unless you're sick of hearing, like, lots of characters going na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, I can't think of anything Kate Sith does here that would be particularly annoying. He's got a lovely voice.
Oh, I could listen to him talk for fucking hours. He's...
Lovely voice. Great animation. And so fun to play. Like, he feels really, like, useful. Random, but, like, if you're okay with that, like, I have smashed fights with him.
Mm.
And that kind of being able to constantly summon the Moogle and use him to attack and then jump off him and use him to distract and all of that stuff, really cool. Yuffie as well, who another character a lot of people said was annoying, but I really liked. Like, my party was always Cloud, Kate Sith, and Yuffie. Well, not always, but, like, that was often it. And that's been mine for most of Rebirth, and both of them, like, Kate Sith and Yuffie, are both so fun. Like, so quick and weird and cool.
Yuffie's been one of my favourites to play as. I really enjoy the ability to do the, like, I'm going to throw my projectile and then take a step back and be doing my sort of magic projectiles while my sort of shuriken is out. And good variety of tools available. Very quick at moving around the battlefield. Very fun to use.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all the characters, like, I've got to, like, give them their dues. With the exception of maybe Red 13, just because I don't like how his, like, character ability works. And that's just a personal thing for me. It's fiddly.
Red's grown on me over time, but is my least favourite. Like, my instinct is I wouldn't opt for playing as Red.
Yeah. Whereas the others, all of them are useful feeling and unique feeling. Like, considering, like, the combat system is a lot of hammering attacks and hoping to god you can dodge in time and hammering, like, commands, but every character feels so different.
My favorite character to play as, like, feel wise might be Barret, and Barret's whole thing is just stand holding down the attack button, backing away, and occasionally set off, like, I'm gonna very quickly fill my ATB and then do one big shoot with my arm.
Yeah,
that feels really good, despite being... There is very little mechanically you have to do with that character, and I love it.
I think part of it is the presentation as well. I mean, the animation, not just on Kate Sith, like, the animation is exquisite all over. Animation that, at least in the combat, isn't so over-animated that it gets in the way.
No.
Like some games do when they try and be too fancy. Movement, I think, is a bit different with some of the decisions they made with, like, what walls they'll suddenly jump up or down from. But in terms of combat, like, everything feels responsive, but is animated to such an exuberant degree that I think part of what makes Barret satisfying isn't so much that he's mechanically exciting. It's that it's so satisfying to just watch him chew through health.
The thing about him that I enjoy watching, 1000%, I think you're right, it's the reload animation. It's that quick little reload he does that, like, when the overcharge meter, like, goes up a little bit and he just pulls the arm back and throws it forward and then he keeps shooting. It's not any longer than it needs to be. It's a visual that feels good when it happens.
Yeah, and that animation really worked. Because every character, when they move an attack, they look how they should. And each one is very distinct. And the way they move communicates a lot of character and a lot of sort of power behind what they're doing. So Yuffie, the way she's slashing and jumping, even though you're just hammering a button half the time, you feel incredibly agile. And then you move over to Barrett, who's like this fucking turret, and then you feel incredibly strong. And just as you flip from character to character and feel different with each one because of how they're presented, I see why it's so satisfying to play a character where most of what you're doing is just holding square. Because they made that feel so fucking good.
Yeah, it's a heck of a game.
Yep. Yes.
It continues to be. What about you, comrade? What you played this week?
I have spent most of this week playing a adventure RPG called The Thaumaturge, which is really very interesting. It's developed by Fool's Theory, a Polish game studio, which will be very relevant. And they've done secondary work on some larger projects. They did some work on, like, Baldur's Gate 3, and they're currently making a remake of The Witcher. So somebody takes them seriously, and I get it, because this is really very cool. It has an interesting setting that you don't see too often, and one that I'm, like, not educated enough to speak to its historical accuracy, but at the same time, a setting that I'm very interested in learning more about. It's 1905 in Poland.
And not the Wild West, which is the only thing I saw of the game when I saw you streaming it.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, certainly been some fashion influence. And yeah, firearms are... When I first started playing it, I'd read nothing. I just saw this thing. I saw some of the visuals. This is interesting. I'm going to check it out. And so I came into it not really fully knowing when or where it was set. And there's an introductory sequence where it sort of gives you a basic sense of what the general gameplay gist is going to be, like a prologue, and sets up a few characters. And I at first thought it was going to be maybe not high fantasy, but I didn't expect it to be as modern as it was. And all of a sudden I'm on a train and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm on a train. So that sort of dates it for me. This could be late 19th century, you know, or later. And I'm like, oh, wait, I'm clearly in Eastern Europe. All right, that narrows it down. Oh, that's Rasputin. Rasputin plays a very significant role in the game. He is at this time traveling around promoting himself as a healer. And he uses hypnosis to address a major aspect of the game. Your character is, as indicated by the title of the game, a thaumaturge. This is a magician of sorts who can draw from items emotional resonances and tie them to individuals that he can identify their resonance as well, and can use their abilities to influence the actions of others. In the setting, these are known to exist, or they're spoken of as existing. There is some discrimination against them. And all of this power is in part derived from them essentially communing with demons. So from the start of the game, you have this demon that has been attached to you since childhood. And the way the demons function is they become attracted to people due to a flaw within them. They feed off of that flaw to gain power. Your particular salutor, as they're called, has been tamed. And you have a relationship with them now. And so a lot of this game, the way you progress through it in a lot of ways, is finding these side quests that will introduce you to more of these salutors. And you have to find the people who have their flaw, take their flaw from them, and then tame the salutor, which takes the form of like a boss encounter. Most of the game revolves around solving the mystery of your father's death in Warsaw, going to environments, walking around, and using an ability that you have to sense objects with powerful resonances. These will sometimes progress your main quest, but more often than not, they're going to open up more side quests in that area, which largely just consist of finding more related objects laying about. And then once you have all of them, it draws a conclusion, and then you can go resolve the quest by going to a specific location at a certain time of day. There is a time cycle. It's not a time limit. It doesn't seem to have any effect on anything if you just pass time to have things available for you to do. But certain things have to happen at certain times in specific environments. You complete these side quests, you get a little bit of flavor text. They're usually related to some sort of cultural thing that would have been happening around the time. Underground fighting clubs and pool halls and exhibits of other cultures that are being hidden from the government for one reason or another. Really interesting stuff. It ties in a lot of the like social pressures and the various groups that were engaging in the lead up to revolutionary action against the czars who are occupying Poland, you know, staging for that whole revolution, which is all very interesting. And the text, of which there is a lot, almost everything in the game is conveyed through text. There are some cutscenes, but for the most part, you're going to be doing a lot of reading, and it is very good reading. The text is great. The voice acting, for the most part, is very good where it exists in cutscenes and conversations with people, with a few exceptions. There's a couple of children who are, they're kids. They did the best they could, but they were not well cast. But all of that stuff is very interesting. And then it has a combat system that I really enjoy. Now, the fact that I'm enjoying it may be because I am playing it on its easiest difficulty, a fact that I will wholly cop to, because I was just way more interested in experiencing this story than I am in dealing with turn-based combat. But I do quite like the way it is set up. Combat takes place over a series of rounds on a timeline, and actions may be faster or slower, and so they may take multiple rounds to complete, and it shows you the timeline of actions of every person engaged in the combat. So you can see when your enemies are going to attack, and in most cases know how they're going to do it because of your abilities as a Thaumaturge. I like that a lot. And it works with your own attacks as well. You have quick attacks. There are attacks that take longer to do. And over time, you will develop attacks that function in chain. If you do the same type of attack repeatedly, you get more powerful versions of them available with each progression. Along with your attacks, you have the salutors that you've collected, which can also perform an attack. Only one of them can do an attack at a time, so you have to select which one to use, but they all have different abilities that are themed to what type of demon they are. And these are drawn from all over the world in various cultures, folklores, which is interesting and nice to see a broad grouping of these kinds of entities. They're all really creepy in their design as well, which I like. It's well suited to the overall visual aesthetic. And a lot of the combat revolves around status effects, receiving them, inflicting them on enemies. Enemies have two main stats that you interact with, being their hit points, which of course determine when they're defeated. And then they have focus, which is Well, it's their focus in the battle. And one of the better strategies to deploy against a lot of enemies is to whittle that down. Because when their focus is eliminated, it interrupts whatever action they had planned, and it opens them up to a very powerful attack, either from you or from your Salutor, or both, if they're still alive after the first one hits. And this also introduces some interesting combat opportunities, because all of these heavy attacks by your Salutors also have some sort of effect that will afflict every enemy that's in the combat still, whether that's putting something akin to a poison effect on them or removing some of their focus. In one case, it doesn't even attack necessarily the enemy that it's targeting. It just attacks a random enemy. And this can be exploited if you know that you're going to be killing that first enemy before it's going to get the opportunity to attack. You use it anyway, and then you're going to deal a bunch of damage to one of your other opponents. So there's a lot going on within that. And then the progression system for it is all tied to the combat. Every upgrade that you apply along these four linear tracks that represent, like, I think it's heart, mind, deed, and word, I think are the four sort of paths you have. Each of the Salutors are tied to one of them. And in fact, they'll gate your progression along these tracks. If you haven't found the Salutor that's necessary at a certain point of the development to progress it further yet, you're just stuck there on that one. And that can come into play because where you are on this progression track also affects some of your ability to discern information from things in your exploration aspect of the gameplay. It can affect conversational choices that you have as well. But every one of these progressions is either a new attack to extend a chain within your attack options or an upgrade. And these upgrades are fascinating because all of your attacks can have an upgrade attached to them that adds an additional effect to your attack. Now, these, as you progress down the line, get more expensive in terms of what attacks they can be slotted into. Attacks can support an upgrade of level 1, 2, or 3, depending on how far along in the combo that they are. And so you are limited in terms of you can't put a more expensive upgrade into a slot that can't handle it. You can put a cheaper one in. And so you get to play around with effects like, okay, this attack could now do 60% more damage when it hits, or it could increase the speed at which my Salutor's next attack goes off, or it inflicts a status effect on the enemy, or adds a status effect to me that makes me more defensive, or restores health or focus to me. Lots and lots of different options for the ways that these can be deployed and arranged around that makes the combat very strategic in some interesting ways. And I really like that approach. It also lets you shuffle these upgrades around before any combat starts. So you can look at the enemies, know what they have available to them to an extent, and then plan accordingly. The enemies also get resistances that can only be removed by certain types of Salutors doing attacks on them. And sometimes it's a good idea to eliminate those, and sometimes it's not necessary, and it all depends on what your strategy for approaching combat is. It's complex without being overwhelming to play. It's very straightforward. I like the clarity that it gives you in terms of being able to anticipate your opponent's strategy. I like the use of status effects and the Salutors and the range of possibilities they offer. The progression system adds a lot to it. It's a good combat system that you don't have to do that much. There's no random encounters. Anytime you wind up in combat, it is based on an encounter that you had, either one you just wandered into, or it's something necessary to progress the quest line, or it's something you could have talked your way out of in a lot of cases. And there is a conversational mechanic that I have avoided interacting with to a certain extent. And I think that that has prevented me a lot of opportunities to avoid combat because it deals with my character's flaw. Often in conversations, you will get opportunities to exhibit your sense of pride, to adjust the conversation. Every time you do this, it ticks up your pride value somewhere in the game. And this will open up other conversational opportunities later down the road, but at the same time, it attaches this sense of risk associated with it. And frankly, most of those responses make you come off like a dick. And I'm just not into them. So there may be more impact from them. I've certainly seen a lot of opportunities that are just denied to me in conversation because I'm not proud enough. And I think that a lot of those probably could have gotten me out of some shit through intimidation. But all the same, it is a really interesting game with a great story that I'm deeply invested in. I will credit them with being unrelenting in their need to point out that Rasputin is a smelly man. It comes up many times that the man stinks to high hell.
It is important to remember that everything he pulled off while stinking real bad.
Mm. Stinking real bad.
In spite of not because of his stank.
That reminds me of that Warlock of Firetop Mountain, the old Fighting Fantasy books. When that one came out for Switch and I live streamed it, like literally every other sentence was describing how much the orcs stank to the point where it started seeming racist for a race that wasn't real.
I am all about this. I'm pretty close to the end, I think. It's very liberal with the experience if you explore everything you can. Which I like. I don't feel cut off from just about anything. There was, I think, one sort of progression choice that I made early on that sort of cut me off from something that I was really interested in because I simply didn't have a high enough rank in one of the tracks, and I could have if I'd applied my points differently.
Right.
But that sort of thing is pretty rare that you wind up cut off from content specifically because you didn't progress in the right way, and it gives you so many experience opportunities to grow just by wandering around and looking at shit that you can, in most cases, be successful in that sense and not really miss much. Really good game. I strongly encourage people to take a look at it. It has a great vibe in its setting. The thaumaturges are interesting conceptually, and the way it translates into this adventure RPG structure works really well. I'm a big fan of this.
That sounds pretty neat.
Yeah. Indeed it does.
Yeah.
You've definitely sold me on giving it a look.
You had me at Smelly Rasputin.
Well, yeah, I did bury the lead. I mean,
you had us all at Smelly Rasputin.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple of other things I can quickly throw in that I had a look at this week. I played the demo for Princess Peach Showtime, which is coming out in a couple of weeks. There's a demo currently on Switch. This game is exactly what I expected it to be, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is what it is. The concept is that you are playing as Princess Peach. You've gone for a night out at the theater. A witch has done some evil at the theater, and now you've got to go hop onto the stage and fight some creatures and do little side-scrolling-y adventures, but on a stage. First thing I was a little disappointed in, Nintendo has in the past done some really interesting stuff with sequences in games designed to be set on a stage. Particularly, I think of Paper Mario. Thousand Year Door in particular consistently had this like very alive feeling silhouetted crowd of an audience watching. Sometimes they would interact with the action that was happening. It very much leaned into the fact it was happening on a stage. There's none of that here. The fact to that here is sometimes things look like they are props. It feels like it was an underutilized aspect of the concept. But basically every level is, here is a unique power-up that will let you do something specific to this one stage. And usually that so far seems to mean either fairly basic combat, like there was a level that was, you were a sword fighter, and you had an attack button, and if you did the attack button at about the right time, you'd do a witch time dodge, and enemies would very slowly come to you and you can hit them with your sword. Or there was a stage where you became a chef, and all of the gameplay would every so often stop, and you have a time limit, and you've got to decorate a cake real quick in a top-down little sequence. And those things are fun, and they're charming. And I think if you go into it expecting not particularly challenging, but quite charmingly presented, it does not seem like there is anything bad going on there, but it also feels like, on the scale of Nintendo's games, I've very much enjoyed some of Nintendo's simpler Switch games. I think of Yoshi's Crafted World being one that I really, really enjoyed, that was not a particularly challenging game, but still felt like there was enough substance to get get a sort of grip on. The thing with Princess Peach Showtime, at least in the demo, is each of the levels feels like it's over before the idea has really had time to be explored. And it's entirely possible that in the full game there will be additional levels with that transformation, and they'll expand upon those ideas a bit further. But right now it feels like you barely scratch the surface of a gameplay style, and then it's like, okay, off to the next thing, in a way that, like, I'm curious to see how it pans out as a full game. One game I can more easily recommend that I played this week that is not a particularly challenging game, but is really charming, and I think does a really good job of having a consistent concept, is Snufkin, Melody of Moomin Valley.
Laura!
Yes!
I saw that on the eShop the other day.
Yeah.
It's Moomin.
It is.
And it's got Sigur Rós doing the soundtrack, and it sounds really
that
pretty.
That it does.
And I saw a trailer for it, and I'm like, that looks twee as fuck. I used to love Moomins as a kid. Getting that.
Okay, let me tell you, it is good.
Yay!
It's maybe 4 or 5 hours long. It's not a particularly lengthy game, but it knows what it wants to be, and it really captures its vibe very well. A Snufkin Melody of Moomin Valley is basically, hey, Snufkin leaves for the winter, comes back after the winter. Moomin Valley's gone through some shit. There are human police officers in Moomin Valley.
What?
Putting up signs being like, this is a manicured garden, no playing games, no having fun.
Moomin Fashy?
They're being Moomin Fashy. There's even one Moomin who's wearing a cop outfit,
no.
Who's opened the cops.
No!
There is a cop Moomin! And you as Snufkin are going, not fucking having that. Additionally, there's some environmental shit that's gone wrong in Moomin Valley. You know, bits of Moomin Valley seem to be dying. It's not looking good. So you as Snufkin come back and basically fix fascism and over-policing and environmental issues. You fix them all entirely through little friendly side quests and playing music.
Amazing.
Doing little stealth missions, sneaking into these, like, patrolled manicured gardens to literally just rip all of the signs out of the garden until the cops look around and go, well, there's no sign saying there are rules that have to be followed here. Why am I policing this? There's no longer a sign that says people can't, like, play ball games on the grass or whatever.
Yeah.
I'll just bugger off. So you're trying to restore nature to Moomin Valley by sneaking around being like, can't police this park if I remove all the signs that say there are rules.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
It's pretty simple. It's not overly taxing. But it is just a nice little top-down adventure of someone needs a thing, go find the thing, play some music at some kind of creature, have a charming little interaction, stand up against the cops, try and work out what's harming nature and go stop it. It's really, really
nice.
Charming. And if you have a soft spot
I
for
do.
Moomin stuff, I think it is well worth, like, 4 or 5 hours you could play the whole thing. And I think that is perfect.
I am up for that.
I had a couple of sittings and I played through it and I had a soul refreshing time.
I fucking love the Moomins. I'm going to put the Moomins on after this. They were the Moomins. They were the Moomins. They were the Moomins. Fucking great.
Right. Fucking love the Moomins.
Right. Fucking Moomins.
And the last one I'll quickly touch on. I can only talk about the first couple of hours of it so far. I'll hopefully be able to talk about it in more depth soon. I've played the first couple of hours in single player of Rise of the Ronin, which is a game I am having a real interesting, like, a pretty good time with, despite... It feels less like a pastiche than it should, right, given that all the ways I want to talk about it are generally by comparing it to other things.
I just want to say quickly that the emotional roller coaster I went on as I heard Rise of the Ro and got really excited, and then heard Nin and got so deflated.
Oh, I'm sorry to have deflated, yeah.
It's due a comeback!
So, Rise of the Ronin is a Dark Souls-y, action-adventure-y kind of game set in 19th century Japan, just as a bunch of people are trying to come in and colonialize Japan from various places. You play as a warrior who is part of something called a pair of blade twins, where the gist is you've been trained up to be, like, stronger as a group. You're sort of two people acting as one. And I'll get back to that in a second. I think it is the most interesting thing I've seen with this game so far that sort of separates it out from the other Soulsy comparisons. But mechanically, there's a whole scattershot number of things I keep wanting to compare it to. It's got your boss fights that feel like your traditional Soulsy fare of here's the big tough fight that you're trying to learn its attack patterns and dodge out the way and all that stuff. It's got raising flags, which is basically bonfires. It's got an Estus flask equivalent, etc. But the difference is, a lot of the time, even in single player, which is what I've played so far and can talk about so far, you will frequently have at least one other character with you when you go on these missions that will be AI controlled, but you can swap to controlling them at any time. A lot of Soulsy type games have this vibe of you are supposed to feel isolated and alone and there is nothing backing you up. And this really leans the other way into you are better with someone else by your side. And mechanically, that plays out in a couple of interesting ways in single player, things like if a boss you're fighting has sort of committed to an attack combo and they are definitely attacking one character, you could swap to the other character who is not being attacked by the boss right now, get a quick opportunity to get in and get some hits in on them. That might come in the form of reviving a downed teammate. So if you're playing in single player and you've got one other AI companion with you, if you get knocked down, you've got at least one opportunity to, as the other character, run over and revive them. But it also plays out with giving you things like increased weapon selection available. Each character can have two weapons on them at a time, but also the other character in the party will have two weapons on them, which means you have, like, even if there's just two people available to you in a mission, that's like four weapons available to swap between. And there is a little degree of some weapon types will have like rock, paper, scissors advantages against others. And that's made pretty clear by like a coloration when you're doing damage to go, is this effective or is it not very effective? And you're less likely to run up against those situations of not having anything available to you that is effective against a particular enemy type, which is really nice. Couple of, like, little details about it that I really enjoyed. You know, in a lot of, like, your Soulsy type games, you pick your class at the start, and that's going to spec you into being good at certain types of weapons, and you pick that, and you're sort of committed to it?
Mm-hmm.
In this, you pick your class or whatever, and then you're set to, like, a little courtyard where there are, like, wooden versions of all the weapons that you can fuck around with. And then it explicitly asks, hey, are you enjoying the weapon type that you committed to being, like, the thing you play with? If not, do you want to go back and, like, rechange what class you are? Now that you've actually had a chance to play around with them for a second. And I appreciate that. It's a nice little quality of life thing.
Yeah, I always like it when, like, that feature in particular is there.
Yeah. I don't know how to talk about it without talking about the things that it's clearly inspired by. You can feel that it's made by the people who made Nioh. There's a lot of elements that remind me of games like Sekiro. You've got this sort of grappling hook mechanic that you can use to, like, traverse through the environment quickly or pull yourself towards enemies or them towards you. You've got this sort of big open worldish aspect that, while definitely not as focused on like you're going to stumble into a boss fight in the middle of a field as Elden Ring was, there is definitely more of an ability to ignore signposting and just go off and do your own thing in this, which is nice. Often you'll end up sneaking up on, you'll find like, oh, here's a little village that's been overtaken by bandits. You defeat all the bandits and now there's shopkeepers with quests and stuff like that that you've opened up. I like the stealth stuff in this. The stealth stuff feels very early Assassin's Creed in a lot of how it feels to move about, But particularly, I really appreciate that while you do, like, let's say you fail a stealth moment and you alert, like, the enemy you're trying to kill is aware you're trying to kill them, you will do a little bit of a, like, an alert in an area around of, like, other enemies will know and come over. It's not particularly big. It's a pretty small radius of enemies becoming aware of you. And what I really appreciate that about that is, if you fuck up a stealth moment, maybe two or three enemies will get alerted usually, and you can, that's a reasonable number to fight off. You can go back to stealth. You haven't fucked up doing stealth for the whole fucking mission. And I really appreciate that ability to go back into stealth after having fucked it up. It plays pretty nicely. I'm finding a lot of mechanics in it that I didn't expect would be mechanics in it. There's like wing gliding suits and shit, which is interesting. The best mechanic by far is if there's a cat nearby, it will show up on your like little mini-map radar where a cat is and how far away it is, and you can go and you can pet the cat.
Lovely.
There's like a little map that goes, there's a cat nearby, do you want to pet it? Not enough games have that as a mechanic.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to interrupt real quick to say that is one of the disappointments of the Thaumaturge. There is a dog, and you can pet the dog, but there are multiple cats, and I have not been allowed to pet one cat.
So many games won't let you pet the cat. It's depressing.
It is.
But yeah, I'm excited to put more time into it, and particularly I want to check out the co-op stuff that's going on with this, because like the co-op elements, even in single player, seem like the most interesting part of it, and they're the thing that I want to have time to dig into. But it's looking promising so far. I'm intrigued by it. But yeah, should we do a couple of newsy bits?
We can. And,
yeah. We'll start with this one. SAG-AFTRA's members might be striking again soon. Do you remember we talked a little while back about the fact that it sure seemed like SAG-AFTRA had maybe fucked over their video game voice actor folks by agreeing to some AI terms?
Yes. Yes, we did a video on that too, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like that isn't going to go away quietly.
Nah.
According to the National Executive Director and Chief Negotiator for SAG-AFTRA, it seems like there's about a 50-50 shot that in the next 4 to 6 weeks, SAG-AFTRA's membership will be striking. Now, specifically, the strike is against game companies and their stances on AI. This is not SAG-AFTRA's video game members taking action against their own upper management. This is, we are striking until the game developers change their stances because our upper management didn't really do that fight for us like they should have done.
Yeah.
That seems to be the understated part of it, is we're going to call for strike action because our bosses didn't fight for us in the last strike. They want to make sure that AI implementation does not replace the work of people. That is, I think, at the core of most, you know, unions right now fighting against AI. People are not pressured into consenting to it and are properly compensated and do not lose jobs over it. So we'll keep an eye open. It seemed like this was probably inevitable. SAG-AFTRA really did kind of fuck over the voice actors a little bit, or the video game voice actors a bit.
Yeah.
Another story. Bobby Kotick. You know, we thought we'd got rid of Bobby Kotick. We were never going to have to think of Bobby Kotick again.
Oh, we dreamed.
That he was just gonna, you know, we hoped quietly he would just go retire with his millions and billions into the night and never fucking be relevant to anyone's lives ever again.
It was always a distant but cozy dream.
Yeah. Bobby Kotick wants to buy TikTok.
Ugh. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure many billionaires do.
And the US government seems keen to give them the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For anyone not aware of this, the US government is currently really, really, really trying to push legislation through that would ban TikTok. Basically, they would go, hey, TikTok's owned by a company in China. You have to sell your American part of the business to someone American or you are banned from the country. Is that a fair summary?
Never mind that this social media network is doing absolutely nothing that many, many, I would dare say every US-owned social media company does to its users.
Yeah, but you can't let China do it, though.
Well,
can't let China do it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it seems like the US government might kind of force TikTok's hand into selling part of their business, and it sure seems like Kotick is looking for other billionaires to team up with to be in charge of TikTok, which means that Kotick would be a name who isn't yet a distant memory for us, which is really what I hoped it would eventually become.
Yeah, that's cool. I really like the idea of that company being overtaken by a group of people we know to be corrupt. Perfect.
Yeah, yeah. Like, even without saying Bobby Kotick, Sam Bankman-Fried is apparently also one of the names floating around.
How does he have any money?
Well, apparently he's got enough money to be like, I'll get on and in on this with
Jesus
you, Bobby.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But you know what? Should we end on a happy story? I've got a good positive story probably.
I would love a good happy story to end things on.
Yes, please.
Let's talk about good unionization stories in the games industry. 600 Activision QA workers have become the video game industry's biggest ever union.
Yay!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hundreds of QA workers voted to unionize, and of the 398 votes, only 8 voted not to unionize, so it was pretty overwhelming. Microsoft voluntarily recognized the union, did not, you know, push back on it.
They know better to fuck around right about now.
Right, exactly. Like, it's not surprising, but it's still good to see them doing the things they said they would do, because I believe they said they would voluntarily recognize any unions from any folks that wanted to do them.
They did, and with the pressure and scrutiny that they're under as a result of the acquisition and immediate layoffs and the FTC trying to reevaluate the deal, I would not do anything that draws possible negative attention to me right now.
Positive things. Apparently, like, reportedly zero evidence of any kind of union busting or discouraging activity, which is really nice. Like, Microsoft apparently were pretty true to their word on being neutral about union negotiations.
It's okay, yeah.
And yeah, this is gonna hopefully mean that a shit ton of QA workers will be able to negotiate for better pay and not have their livelihoods be as precarious as QA workers tend to be.
That's great news.
That would be good, yeah.
Good for them.
It's nice to have a good one. Nice for a win.
It's nice to see that, like, that snowball of unionization that started, what, like a year and a half or so ago when we started getting those video game unions really does seem to be picking up steam.
Yeah.
We're seeing more and more of them and bigger unions, and that is only good for the industry.
Yep.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
So, yeah, there you go. That's a good one. Something good happened.
Something good happened. Well, Laura.
Me?
In your portfolio, something good is always happening because you're always producing lovely content. And could you tell us about it, please?
Oh, you can find all the stuff I'm putting out on the internet at Laura K. Buzz, wherever you happen to find stuff. All the social medias, I'm probably there. I've got a video going up on Friday about the Logitech Adaptive Gaming Kit for the PlayStation Access controller and what it is and how it's in any way distinct from the Xbox Adaptive Controller button kit that Logitech put out. So look forward to that. Just Laura K. Buzz. You'll find all the stuff. What about you, Conrad?
Oh, you could find me at Conrad Zimmerman on Twitter and Blue Sky. You could hang out with me on Twitch at twitch.tv/thatconradzimmerman, where I think I'm going to be playing some Balatro. You could buy anti-capitalist propaganda and Jimquisition merchandise from me at mercenarycreative.com. And everything that I do online gets supported through Patreon at patreon.com/fistshark. And you know who else has a Patreon? Stephanie Sterling.
That is correct. Patreon.com/Jimquisition. That supports this show. That supports the Jimquisition. It supports the reviews that are on thejimquisition.com. Over on thejimquisition.com, we've got reviews up currently for, what did I do? Outlast Trials. Pretty good game. And Pacific Drive. Those are two that I've got up right now. And we should have one for, well, we'll have the one I can't talk about next week. And Final Fantasy VII, as soon as I get to the end and find out, like, just how they made that interesting. So until then, thank you all so much for listening. We will see you next week. Bye.
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 Ba 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 ba